How many times have you seen Dances with Wolves? 100, 200? Oh, jeez. You have seen it that many times, haven't you?
Hallie, we're like twins.
People never seen an Indian do stand-up comedy before, you know? Like, for so long, you probably thought that Indians never had a sense of humor, you know? We never thought you were too funny either.
Hello and welcome to Twindigenous.
Hi.
Hey, Kara.
Hi, Kaylee.
I swear you always ask like a question.
It's because I don't quite know how to respond to your enthusiasm and your energy.
Just take it in, is what I say. How you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing okay. Hanging in there, you know. These are still very odd times that we were all living in, and I'm feeling it.
I hear that. Yeah, and actually we took a little break last week, so if you're back with us this week, thanks for joining us again, and we're happy to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, we had recorded a little episode. It just wasn't working out, so
we're no longer together. No, we were like, for whatever reason, we were both exhausted. We were having tech issues. We recorded something. It wasn't our best. I think there was some good stuff, so maybe we'll save that for other things in the future. But we wanted to come back strong and just take a little break, you know, focus on ourselves, focus on our mental health and everything, which is important. And we hope you do the same whenever you need to. But yeah, we are really excited to be back. And Kara, what's on your mind these days? What you been watching? What you been reading? What you been taking in?
Oh no, horrible things.
Please, that's what we want. We want to know. Normalize
okay.
This.
Okay. You know, Kaylee, I am very ashamed that I have an addiction to the Real Housewives of New Jersey. And I blame that on you. You introduced me to the show. I'm very much a latecomer to the Housewives. Never thought I would like it. Never thought it would be my thing. When I tell you that I am so addicted to this show, I don't know why. They're in a brand new season. It's drama. It's a lesson in psychology.
I'll say.
And human behavior. Yeah, I have been watching a lot of Housewives, and it's very much a guilty pleasure show, and I definitely feel guilty for enjoying it as much as I do.
But why? The thing is, like, there's a thing, and I get it, because I've felt that way before, too. But I often hear, you know, when people watch reality TV or whatever they call it, a guilty pleasure. But you know what? If it makes you, if it gives you something to laugh about or something to, you know, just not like, because it's not heavy material, you know. Sometimes, and we need levity, and we need stuff to laugh at, we need to like go like, wow, that's really bizarre, that's really stupid, or you know, like sometimes we just need that content that's not, you know, maybe it's not teaching us things, but it's giving us a little bit of a reprieve from the weight of the world.
You're right. And you know, like, just kind of going back to what I said a minute ago, it's a lesson in psychology. It really is, you know, that, and, you know, your 90 Day Fiance series. Like, I have learned so much about people and what makes them tick and relationships and the things I never expected to be learning from these shows. And granted, no reality show is actually reality.
No.
Just putting that out there. It's just a lot of the things that happen, you know, the things that happen to these people, it gets me thinking, you know, it just makes me question, huh, maybe I didn't handle this situation in my life the way I should have. And I'm watching these other people deal with, you know, not similar things, but other things with similar thought patterns, I should say. But yeah.
I hear that. If you had to be a contestant or a participant on any reality show, what would you pick? Could be still in the air or something from back in the day.
Well, when you say contestant, does that mean it has to be a competition reality show?
No, No, I mean, like, either it could be that or some kind of participant in any way, a cast member or whatever.
Right. Well, it would not be one of the Housewives shows. I feel like a lot of times in real life, their real lives get upended, you know, coming from consequences of them being on the show and having that weird sort of fame. You know, I love RuPaul's Drag Race as far as a competition show. Because it's got a little bit of everything. It's got performing, it's got, you know, making costumes, creativity.
You'd be good at that, yeah.
I love to walk a runway, you know this.
Okay, listeners, I have to share this. For anyone who has never seen Kara Morrison do her runway walk, it is so fucking fierce. I don't know how she does it, but Kara has an amazing... We're going to have to get you... I'm sorry, but we're going to have to get you to do a video of that or something. But you do that thing that Tyra talked about on America's Next Top Model once, like, years ago, where, like, Kara's able to find the wind. Like, you can find the wind in your hair, and, like, you, the way you walk, it makes your hair just go... You know? It's so damn good. It's so damn fierce. And kudos... And congratulations to you on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I wasn't expecting those compliments. but no, I've been practicing my runway walk since I was a little kid for no other reason other than my own entertainment. And I have walked the runway before. So have you. You've done a few.
That's true. We're short, so we're not probably going to go into this super professionally. But we've been lucky to have a couple of modeling opportunities.
Yeah, it's not my thing though. I'm particularly camera shy when it comes to quote unquote modeling. I mean, I've tried my hand at it a few times, but yeah, it's a thing.
I like it, but it has to be the right setting, just like any other thing, you know. But yeah, no, I hear you. I think it would be great. Well, what Drag Race.
What about you as far as, you know, a show that you would do?
Honestly, I would say the same. I love making, like, I love, like, crafting. I'm not a seamstress. You can sew, Kara. I can't sew. So I wouldn't be good at, like, sewing challenges, but I can hot glue the shit out of something and make it look nice, I will say.
You can.
but since you already said that one, let's see, what else is there? It would have to be something I wouldn't really care about, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
I always loved America's Next Top Model back in the day. I don't think I could stand to watch it if they were... Are they still making it?
I have no idea.
I'm not that, like, 6 foot tall, 100 and whatever pounds, you know, stick thin, typical model, but I thought they did a lot of cool shoots that I think would be fun to participate in. But they also did a shit ton of problematic shoots.
Yes, they did.
Oh my god, like, they would do where they would, like, swap people's races and dress them up as different cultures, and, like, in some cases have them, like, in black face or red face or yellow face, and a lot of America's Next Model did not age well for many, many reasons. No, but yeah, other things. Oh, Deb Holland had her confirmation hearings this week. We still don't know if she's going to be she's in, for any of those of you who are not familiar, Deb Holland has been nominated for the position of Secretary of the Interior, and she's a Native woman, and we're hoping she gets confirmed, but there's, of course, some Republican opposition, but should she get confirmed, I think she will be great in that position. Fingers crossed she gets confirmed, but I guess we'll find out soon. And two, you know, maybe we'll find out. I don't know when we're supposed to find out, but maybe by the time this airs, we'll know either way. I also wanted to give a book recommendation. I've been reading this great book called We Had a Little Real Estate Problem by, I believe his name is pronounced Cliff Nesteroff. I could be wrong. But it's a book about basically, like, the history of natives in comedy. And so it kind of jumps back and forth between modern natives that work in comedy and, you know, historical events and historical figures within comedy and yeah, different native historical events. But it's so good. The author is not native, but I think his approach is really respectful, and it's just super entertaining, great, great book. So I'm only a few chapters in, but loving it so far. So recommend that. Okay, I'm excited to get into this episode today. Are you?
I sure am. Yeah.
I thought you were frozen. We record these on Zoom, and so sometimes I'm not sure if how like the timing is working. If you're just not reacting, or
you know, I've honestly, in the age of Zoom that we're living in now, I've learned that I have some kind of lag. I'm not calling myself stupid, but I am slow to respond to people, and I didn't realize it. I think it just takes me a second to warm up and get the gears turning. I don't know what it is, but people like, hello. It's like, I'm like, no, I'm here. I'm opening my mouth to respond to you. I just need a second to get my words right. But
I think maybe particularly especially in certain settings, you're a very contemplative person. Like, I think you take the time to absorb things and respond in the way that you feel comfortable. And I think a lot of people just blurt stuff out, and you're not like that. And I think maybe over Zoom, it's harder to tell us what you're doing.
Yes, I think you're exactly right.
It's just a theory. But yeah, so we're kind of back to our original format today, and we are going to change things up. We're going to have some more conversational episodes. We're going to, you know, still cover these stories. But yeah, we would love to hear from you on what you think. But why don't we go ahead and dive into our stuff that we have planned for today. How should we go about that? We didn't talk about how to do it.
Well, just to brush everybody up on our format that we are revisiting today. So we're going to share a pop culture story and a native culture story. Kaylee did pop culture, right?
Yes.
Just making sure. And I'm going to cover our native culture story. I don't know why. I just feel like I like to do pop first, if that's okay.
That's fine.
And so both will have, they'll share a common theme. But you want to share that, Kaylee?
Yeah, well, like our theme was kind of loose this week in that it's more like it was very broad. But basically our theme was dance. And we both interpreted that as we chose. And went away and did some research. And now we both have stories for you. And so, yes, as Kara mentioned, I have the pop culture story this week. And I thought, okay, dance. Who are some famous dancers? That led into what are some famous styles of dance? And that led me to the history of ball culture and voguing.
Oh, cool.
Okay. So, voguing, as I'm sure, unless you've been living under a rock, buried under an ocean on planet Jupiter, I'm sure you probably know at least vaguely what voguing is.
Wow.
So voguing was born in the Harlem ballroom scene, and ballroom events were the creation of members of the Black and Latinx LGBTQ+ community, and they were these over-the-top events that consisted of intense competitions where contestants would battle it out in fashion, runway walks, lip-syncing, and dancing categories. And so what happened was, when you would participate in a ball in any given category, you could win trophies, awards, and of course you would win bragging rights. And I don't think any modern story on the ballroom scene or voguing would be complete without a mention of the iconic documentary Paris is Burning by filmmaker Jenny Livingston. And so I did watch the film, and I'll talk more about the film as I tell my story. Yeah, I'm going to share a quote from they didn't mention who this person was in the documentary, but it was just an unnamed ball contestant. But they said, "I went to a ball, I got a trophy, and now everyone wants to know me." Which, wow. I thought was pretty cool. Yeah. So in the documentary, Paris is Burning, we meet a drag queen named Dorian Corey, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a bit. Mm-hmm. And Dorian Corey provides most of the narration for the film. And they say that They call them competitions, but believe me, they're wars, and they often lead to fights. And of course, like when you're at a ball, and if you've never seen what a ball looks like, it's not like a Cinderella goes to the ball. I mean, I'm sure there's influence from that kind of thing. But like, oh my God, they're so stunning. There's lots of just really beautiful like performances and just really kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Campy, kind of like campy somewhat. Some things are campy. Some things are more reaching for what they call realness or like, you know, realism. But it's very over the top, and it's just fascinating and gorgeous and interesting and super artistic. So, but they were competitions, and things would get really intense, and people would be throwing shade. And of course, in the film, Dorian Corey gives us these iconic explanations of what these terms mean, terms like shade and reading. And Dorian says, shade comes from reading. Reading came first. You get in a smart crack and everyone laughs and kikis because you found a flaw and exaggerated it. And then you've got a good read going. And then Dorian goes on to explain what shade is. Shade is, I don't tell you you're ugly, but I don't have to tell you because you know you're ugly. And that's shade. I love it. It's so funny. But back to kind of ball culture at large. So often competitors would represent houses, which were groups of artists and performers that chose to collaborate and support each other. And really, and this is kind of the cool thing, for the most part, houses were and are, because they're still around, seen as chosen family, especially given that many members of the LGBTQ plus community, especially at that time, had strained or negative or non-existent relationships with their birth families. There was a queen named Pepa LaBeija, which you may have heard of, like the House of LaBeija, who at one point was the mother. They didn't found the House of LaBeija, but they were the mother, kind of like the leader of and mother maternal figure of the House of LaBeija. And in Paris is Burning, they talk about how they were rejected by their parents. In fact, Pepper LaBeija tells a story about how their dad once saw them out in public dressed as a woman and went home and told their mom, and like their mom eventually reacted really badly and got this mink coat and took it out and burned it in the backyard. And there's like countless stories like that, unfortunately. And of course, not everyone's family reacted that way, but there's lots of stories like that. And so Pepa LaBeija goes on to talk about how these houses really were a chance for young gay people to fill that void that they needed, or that void of the family that they needed. So some notable houses of this era include the House of LaBeija, the House of Ebony, Aviance, Dupree, Extravaganza, Ninja, and those are just a few. There's really a lot more. And at the time, most of these houses consisted of only Black members, with the exception of the House of Extravaganza, which was a Latinx house. Another exception was the House of Ninja, which by most accounts was amongst one of the more inclusive and diverse houses, because they had members of all different communities and races in the House of Ninja. And it was the legendary Willie Ninja, along with Sandy Apollonia Ninja, who founded the House of Ninja. I'm just getting like tingles already. I'd seen Paris is Burning before and knew about Willie Ninja and the House of Ninja, and like just always found them also beautiful and interesting. So Willie Ninja, like, just, anyway, I'll get to it. But I'm excited. So Willie Ninja and Sandy Apollonia Ninja founded the House of Ninja. And Willie started the house after winning a few grand prizes. And it's said that the name Ninja came from Willie's interest in martial arts and Asian culture. And so Willie was Black and perhaps some other mixed ancestry. But it was interesting, like some people have said, like, hey, that's cultural appropriation. So it's to be called Ninja and then, you know, taking some influence from martial arts and stuff. And obviously, I'm not Asian, so I'm not going to speak to that, but I found that interesting. But back to Willie specifically. So Willie wanted ballroom culture to become internationally known. So really, ballroom culture was super underground. So it was a subcultural phenomenon. People, you know, straight people, wealthy people, people who were kind of, you know, running the mainstream at the time, they didn't know what the hell ballroom culture was. And they probably certainly weren't at the time interested in it. And this is, keep in mind, this is like 70s, 80s. This is kind of the era I'm talking about, mostly kind of like mid 80s. But yeah, so Willie also from the get-go wanted to be a big star and is even quoted as saying, "I want to be a big star known in every corner of the world, maybe as a choreographer, a famous dancer, a singer." And of course, Willie was a self-taught dancer and quickly became known throughout the ballroom scene for his clean, sharp movement and style of dance. This, of course, led to his contribution to one of the most iconic dances of all time, voguing. And Kara, have you seen Willie Ninja?
I mean, I've seen Paris is Burning. It's been years, though. So I remember a few of like the key players, but maybe if you keep going, I'll start to kind of remember more of this.
Yeah, I guarantee you, like, if I showed you a little video and didn't tell you, you would know. You would know it was him.
Yeah.
But yeah, very iconic, just super, super talented. And yeah, all self-taught. Now, Willie Ninja did not invent voguing, but he's often referred to as the godfather of Vogue and is credited with really perfecting the dance and helping bring it to the mainstream. And of course, it was named after the magazine because, you know, it's a dance that consists of poses, and a lot of these poses were, you know, inspired by high fashion magazine modeling poses. But voguing is also said to have taken inspiration from, and I didn't know this, from ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. I can see that now that I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gymnastics and also focusing on the lines of the body. So yeah, voguing is a super like angular dance. It's not like a lyrical style dance where you're kind of flowing very fluidly. But voguing was also created with a very specific purpose. And I didn't know this. So in Paris is Burning, Willie Ninja says, "Voguing is the same thing as taking two knives and cutting each other, but in dance form." Which I love that. Probably a lot less deadly. Oh, although, you know, I think it probably does kill your spirit if you be really bad at a vogue battle. Mm-hmm. Willie Ninja also said, "Voguing is a safe form of throwing shade." So it really was like after I rewatched this and really thought about it that way, it really is like there's a lot of like in your faceness, you know, like a lot of what am I looking for? It's very confrontational, I think. And you know, what other dance is really like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess like break dancing, you would have like battles and stuff. But this one, like you're really like making eye contact and stuff. So like many other genres of dance, Vogue has many different styles and steps that can be interchanged depending on what the performer is presenting. Things like different poses. There's, of course, like the duck walk, and that's when you're like kind of sitting on your, almost like you're sitting on your ankles and moving. How to better describe it.
I can't believe I didn't know what that was called.
You did? Oh, okay. It's duck walk, yeah. Because you're kind of walking around like a duck.
I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. I didn't know.
All right. And you also see like the dips where like people are like shablam and like just kind of like smacking the floor. Like they're already low to the ground and they're kind of like smacking onto the floor. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
It looks really hard. I know I've seen pre-pandemic Vogue classes locally that I was like, oh, I want to take that. I never got to, but I think it'd be really cool to learn that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, voguing leapt from the underground to massive popularity. And this is probably why we all know it, for those of us who weren't alive and part of that community at that time. But we mostly, the general public, know voguing because of the release of the song and video Vogue by Madonna. Now, that might sound like a good thing, and maybe in some ways it is, but Madonna did and does receive a lot of criticism, because there's many, especially from that community and from the ballroom scene, that really feel like she exploited it. And, you know, people also call it cultural appropriation, because it was adopting certain aspects of a minority or disadvantaged culture by a member of, you know, kind of mainstream majority. And a lot of people feel like she didn't really properly acknowledge the origins of voguing. And, but, you know, there were some people from that time and scene and community that really helped her create all of this. And because the music video was choreographed by Jose, oh, I don't know how to pronounce his name. Jose Gutierrez Extravaganza, and Luis Camacho of the House of Extravaganza. And I don't know if you remember, but there's a part in the song where she lists celebrities like Jean Harlow, Marilyn Monroe, Joe DiMaggio.
I just remember she goes, Greta Garbo. Yeah.
Something. Yeah. Gave good face. Yeah. I don't know why. Oh, I guess I'm going into the Madonna British accent era, even though that wasn't the same time, but I'm giving her the accent. But yeah, some people also criticized the fact that like all the people she mentioned in the song were all white. And she too is of course white, even though this community really was Black and Latinx. And apparently, yeah, Madonna referenced the Harlem ballroom culture by including members of the community in the production of the video, but critics still say that she really erased its origins and the culture that it came from. So the rise of the popularity of voguing was covered in the documentary Paris is Burning. And I want to mention that that movie started filming in 1986, but it wasn't released until 1990. And the thing that always, because I didn't watch it until maybe 2014, 2015 for the first time. And of course, you know, me being in the age of Google, I looked everybody up to see like, oh, what happened to them? Are they still alive? Are they successful? Did they ever hit big, you know? And like, it's really sad, but a lot of the stars of the film are no longer with us for a variety of reasons. And that includes Willie Ninja, who died in 2006 of AIDS-related heart failure. And yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about, so that's kind of like the history of voguing. Of course, we still see it. A lot of times we see it, people like making fun of it or being silly. I remember watching a video recently of like, it was a kid from, who was it? Kara, did I send this to you? Where it was a kid, it was like a home video of like his bar mitzvah. It had to be like the early 90s. And he was voguing the house down. Like he had come with a prepared routine.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. And so, yeah, we see it. Like people know what voguing is. Everyone's parodied it at one point or another. Who do you think would win if you and I were in a Vogue battle?
Don't tell me how I knew. I knew you were going to take it there. Oh, boy. That's a hard question.
Okay, well, what do you think you would have in your favor, and what do you think I would have in my favor? And we can let the listeners decide for themselves.
Oh, my gosh. Well, for one, I think that I take people by surprise a little bit more than you do.
You do.
I think that people think I am a lot more, I don't know if this is the right word, but I think people think that I'm a lot more shy than I am.
Reserved,
yes. And so when I whip out this sort of like, these like outlandish moves and craziness, I think it really like stuns people. It, you know, I've gotten involved in many a dance-off in my years. But, if anything, it would be the element of surprise in my favor. It would be close between me and you, though.
Here's the thing. I totally agree with you. I think you have mastered the element of fierceness, surprise. And I think I am good at, let me just jump in here and do this thing. Like, let me just bite the bullet and enter this contest. I think you would hesitate to enter the contest. So if we could get you to enter the contest, am I wrong?
Oh, yeah. what are you talking about? Hesitant to enter a dance contest?
Like, I don't know.
You don't know me, ma'am. You don't know me.
No, I know I've seen you do it before, but it's been a while. I don't know where you are with that.
Well, callers call in. The lines are open. We have eyewitnesses on the line. No.
Okay, I'll give to you. I think you would probably I think I dance more than you dance.
Callers.
Oh my god.
The lines are lighting up.
No, but it's not. I mean, I have worked professionally. No, I don't know about that. But I have been known to work as a go-go dancer and a burlesque dancer. Mm-hmm. But it's not the same style, so I don't know that it would work.
If we're talking about, like, this is a party or, like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what kind of scenario is, like...
That's also the thing, and that's, thank you for bringing that up, because I think you're also very environmental, and that you're very sensitive to the setting of things.
Yes. Yes.
And, like, if you're not feeling it, you're not doing it, which I admire.
That is true. That is true. However, if it was an environment where I felt comfortable, and the music does not matter that much to me, let me just say. I mean, you want to put on some Beethoven, I will get down. I love a challenge as far as the music. Put on your worst dud. I don't care. I will find a way to tear up the floor with it. But if the environment was right, the people were right, like if I was feeling it, and you're asking me who would win, I put my money on Kara Morrison.
Okay. Maybe we're going to have to do this. A virtual, virtual program. We'll see. Anyway.
Well, what's your answer?
I think you could win, but I also think I could win. I think it just depends. It depends on the weather, which way the wind is blowing, how much soda I've had that day. I don't know. It just depends.
Let me tell you, the only thing that would hold me back is a neck injury.
That could be arranged. I'm just kidding.
No, but it's just because I'm very much into the hair whipping.
Yes.
That's where a lot of my power releases from. So anything else, I'm game.
Well, I think we're in one way or another, we're gonna have to find out. So just stay tuned, listeners. We're gonna bring this to you. I think.
And thanks for everybody who called in on the lines. Just to verify.
Right. I'm sure your phone was ringing off the hook.
It was.
Anyway, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the movie Paris is Burning. And Kara, I know it's been a while, but I know you've seen it. But yeah, while I was doing research for this story, you know, like I said, I had seen this movie years ago. And I've always heard it quoted by, you know, famous drag queens. It's just iconic. You know, RuPaul, for example, quotes it all the time and makes references to it all the time. But I, until last night when I was, you know, looking at all the stuff, I didn't realize how much backlash there was and unfavorability there was towards the film. And that's mostly by the members of the ballroom community and the people who were featured in the film and their friends and family and surviving members. But I think that they felt that maybe it focused too much on the negative. There are lots of people that feel the opposite. They think it was a good balance of the great things about ball culture and maybe some of the more tragic elements that come like the family relationships and of course some of the sad. And I don't know that I want to give spoilers away, but also this movie has been out for like 30 years. So, but yeah, there's a few things from the movie that really and things I've learned about the movie since that really stick out to me. And so we meet a young trans woman in the film named Venus Extravaganza. And she's very beautiful. She's very sweet. She's it seems like she's had a hard life. And I do want to note, I read an article that was an interview with her nephew, and the nephew didn't get to know her very well because he was very young when she passed. But it seems that her family doesn't like, people seem to watch the movie and think that she didn't get along with her family, and the family says that's not true. So I just want to put that out there. But she had a quote in the film that I really appreciated. She said, "Some of them think we're sick, we're crazy, and some of them think that we're the most gorgeous, special things on earth." She also says, "I would like to be a spoiled, rich white girl. They get what they want whenever they want it. They don't really have to struggle with finances." Venus also talks about wanting to have an operation to become a woman in every way. And she says that she doesn't feel like a man at all. And like, it's, you know, obviously the vocabulary was a little different then, but she was a transgender woman. And once again, spoiler alert, but we do find out in the course of the film, because the film did shoot over several years, that she was murdered, and it was awful. And, you know, it's suspected that it was just, you know, trans-related violence, because she tells a story earlier in the film about a man discovering that she was trans and threatening her and her being terrified. And for some reason, Venus Extravaganza really, something about her story just really like struck a chord in me and just struck me as super tragic. But I also think she was just beautiful and just trying to live her life, and just a beautiful young woman, and probably didn't know, had no idea that she was going to have still lasting impact and legacy. But she did. Yeah. And there's a lot of interesting, throughout the movie, not just Venus, but other characters that we meet throughout the movie, of equating whiteness with wealth and the desire for wealth. And, you know, yeah, I just found that really interesting. It made me wonder, because yeah, this ball culture, it really just focused mainly on Black and Latinx individuals and people from those communities. But I do wonder, like, I wonder if there were any Native performers or queens or members of the LGBTQ+ community then that were part of the scene. Maybe we haven't heard their stories, or other backgrounds too. I don't personally know of any, and I think if those stories are out there, it'd be cool to learn about them. But yeah, I also want to point out, and I'll tell the story really quickly, but or maybe I'll tell you listeners to go look it up. But Doreen Corey, who once again, as I mentioned, was the drag queen who really kind of gave the narration for the film. There's a really bizarre story that we found out after Doreen Corey's passing. There was a mummy in her home found after she died. And so, yeah, I won't go into that anymore, but I will tell you, you can go look that up. Doreen Corey. Yeah. So yeah, Kara, thoughts?
I wish I'd seen the movie. Last time I saw it, it's been probably a good four or five years. It did teach me a lot. That's what I remember from it. I don't remember everybody's names. I don't remember all of the different storylines in the movie, but I remember before watching it not having this idea of what ballroom culture was. I had heard of it. Honestly, this is my mistake. When I used to hear drag queens talk about being a part of ballroom and ballroom culture, this is so silly, I had the thought that they were just doing actual ballroom dancing and drag.
And I thought that too.
I was like, oh, that's cute. Not what it is at all.
Yeah, I think too, like, and then like when I got a little bit better of an idea of it, I thought like, oh, it's like a drag show. And it's not really. It's a competition, and there's all these different categories. And yeah, it's and not all the performers or contestants are drag performers.
Yeah. Yes, you're right about that. But yeah, the movie, it really gave me a good idea of that time period. It's all done in New York, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that time in New York was such a unique time. So interesting, because it does feel very underground the way it's presented in the movie. And of course it was. But yeah, it just seems like a hell of a lot of fun in some aspects. So of course there's a lot of tragedy to the movie too.
Yeah, that's what I thought was interesting about it, was it just seemed like such an exploration of extremes, where it was just the height of glamour and the height of fun and the height of like love of a chosen family. But then also, like, you know, that was the time of when, you know, the AIDS epidemic hit really big. That was when, you know, it was much more dangerous. And of course it's still very dangerous today, but it was much more dangerous for LGBTQ plus individuals to just live their lives. And New York in general back then was just way more dangerous, more violent place. It's, of course, it still has, you know, its problems, but like back then it was very violent, very dangerous.
I mean, it still is.
No, it still is, but like it really was different back then. It really, really was.
I don't know about that.
No, I'm telling you. Like there is, don't get me wrong, there still is violence and there still is crime that happens in New York, but it has changed. Like you used to cannot go to like Times Square, for example, like that's a whole different place. The fact that like tourists go there now and that's a tourist destination is crazy compared to what it used to be.
I understand that. I guess I just mean that there still are trans individuals that are highly targeted. It is more a part of the general conversation now. We're talking about trans people more. And I don't know what I'm saying. I guess I'm just trying to stick up for trans people in the modern day.
Yes. And when I was saying it's less dangerous and less crime, I definitely meant generally, but I'm glad you said that, because it is absolutely important to point out that it's still extremely dangerous for particularly trans people of color. And yeah, I'm glad that it's a conversation, but we still have a hell of a long way to go as a society, a hell of a long way to go as individuals. But no, you're right. And it really is discouraging to see that that still happens. But yeah, for Paris is Burning, I do think the criticisms from the people from the ball scene is totally fair. I also think it's good viewing. I think just make your own call on that and just listen to the voices, because it really just seems like there's mixed feelings on the film.
Yeah, I definitely, okay, so this is something I do remember feeling after I watched it. After I watched it, I was like, Madonna really ripped them off. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like what you were talking about earlier, I definitely feel like she appropriated that and just kind of lifted this sort of quote unquote underground part of the culture and made it into like a mainstream hit song. And yes, she featured people in her videos, but we see that happen with other, you know, sections of society where they may contribute to a mainstream project, but they're not really placed in the forefront.
Right. And mainstream pop culture has always done that. They've always taken from the LGBTQ plus community and, yeah, just rip them off and, you know, parade around. This is new. This is fun. This is our idea. And it's just not that. And Madonna, I think particularly, she's an interesting figure to me, because I feel like it wasn't an isolated incident, you know, and, you know, she's a talented artist. Obviously she's got very loyal fans. But I felt like she often like she meant well. She's like, oh, isn't this great? Like, I think she always thought of herself as an ally. And I'm sure many people would consider her an ally, but I think she also did some stuff that was kind of exploitative and not cool. I know there were some issues surrounding her documentary, Truth or Dare. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's Truth or Dare.
Yeah. Yeah, she got sued for that film because she really kind of outed people, and I think some of her behavior in that movie wasn't really cool. So yeah, she's interesting to me. Because yeah, I think especially back then people thought like, oh, I'm bringing this underground thing to the forefront, but they're not like taking the time to say, but it's not my thing. Because a lot of people do. Most straight Americans, I would guess, probably when they hear voguing, they think of Madonna, and they really should be thinking of Willie Ninja and ballroom culture and all these people who didn't get to become. They were just as big of stars as stars. They were just as big stars as Madonna internally, but because of the prejudice of the world we live in, they weren't allowed to externally or fame or success wise become as big of stars as Madonna, I think, because like these people are stars and just have that charisma and talent, and you know, they have it tenfold, and unfortunately just didn't get the credit that they deserve.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, that's the history and a little bit of the story of ballroom culture and voguing. And I got a lot of my information obviously from the film Paris is Burning, Wikipedia. Those are my main sources. Yeah.
That takes me back to college, Wikipedia.
What you got for us, Karen?
Yeah. So today, with the theme being dance and dancers, you know, I could have gone the route of talking about traditional cultural dances, but I figured there's going to be plenty of opportunity for us to do that in the future. And I just had this particular person in mind for the last several weeks. So I thought, hey, I should talk about her. And she is Maria Tallchief.
Ooh.
Yes. So if you've never heard of Maria Tallchief, she actually was for a very long time, definitely hands down America's most well-known famous ballerina, if not, you know, just in America, also the world. But let's dive into a little bit of her background. So Maria was actually born Elizabeth Marie Tallchief, and her nickname was Betty. So not Maria.
It's interesting. She has two very common middle names as her name, because I feel like it's always like Elizabeth or Marie.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Just an observation. Sorry. Yeah.
So her family, for the most part, either called her Betty or Betty Marie. So that was her name that she went by. But she was born in 1925 in Fairfax, Oklahoma. And she's actually a member of the Osage tribe. Now, her mom was actually a Scotch-Irish lady. It was her father who was Osage. But when she was 8 years old, her mom decided that she wanted to move the family to California because she noticed that her kids had a lot of artistic talent. And she thought, hey, you know, I should pick them up, take them to California and get them involved in different things in the arts. She had in her mind, and I'm not sure why, I didn't find this out, but she had in her mind that Maria was actually going to be a famous concert pianist. She, you know, she really had her practicing the piano, and, you know, apparently she was very good, but she really just thought that was going to be Maria's ticket in life. But she was actually had been taking dance lessons and ballet lessons since she was 3, and she just got better and better at it. And she was just so good. And her younger sister, Marjorie, was actually a dancer as well, ballet.
Ever have a voguing battle is my question.
I don't believe so. So, it is what it is. I'm glad that they got opportunity by moving to California. I did want to note that their mother did encourage them to be active in their culture. So their mother encouraged them to be involved in traditional dances of the Osage. So I thought that was really cool that their mom was cool. Really mm-hmm. about them learning and knowing their culture.
Right. And I want to point out, I think it's just in case anyone's wondering, like, why I think that's so cool. Of course, why wouldn't you want to do that? But back then, like, assimilation, even now, assimilation was so rewarded that to connect to your culture was really an act of rebellion almost. So,
yes. And I did, in at least one place, I kind of got the feeling that Maria over in California was bullied for being Native. So
of course.
Of course she was. But yeah, so she studies ballet with great intensity her entire life. After she graduates high school, she spent years and years of dedicated training and auditioning. She got to travel to New York, where she began working as an apprentice with the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, which was like a touring company based in New York where they would go out and perform, you know, very prestigious ballets. And a few years later, she became a member of that ballet company. And it is believed that it was actually some of the higher ups within that company that actually requested that she change her name. Like I said before, she had always gone by Betty Marie Tallchief, but they wanted her to change her name to Maria Talcheva. Just a side note, I'm guessing with the Talcheva. So at this time, ballerinas of great note were not typically American. They were usually European. They were usually Russian. So I'm kind of guessing, it's just my speculation, that that name change was to A, erase the very obvious ties to her Osage family, but also just to give her a more European or Russian sounding last name.
Right. I was wondering, like, there's no way they at that time they just, you know, come on in, you know, like, right. even like Misty Copeland, who is a modern contemporary figure. And all kinds of ballerinas of color have an extremely hard time getting their pointed foot in the door. So I knew somewhere along the line.
Right.
So yeah, I didn't realize that they had won her. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Right. So she offered to compromise. She said that she was not changing her last name. She was keeping Tallchief, but she did agree to change her first name to Maria. So after that, she became Maria Tallchief as we know her today. So, and mind you, this is in the 40s. So in 1944, a famed Russian choreographer named, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, George Balanchine, joined the Ballet Russe. And 2 years later, he and Maria actually got married and she became his muse. He choreographed a number of lead roles in ballets like Swan Lake and The Nutcracker and The Firebird for her, based on her particular style of dance and technique. And it's said that her particular portrayal of the Sugar Plum Fairy in The Nutcracker is what caused that particular ballet to reach the level of popularity that it still has in the U.S. today. And her role in The Firebird that he choreographed for her actually earned her that nickname. So in a lot of places, you'll hear Maria Tallchief, The Firebird, or Oklahoma's Firebird. That's sort of her nickname based on her part in that ballet. By the late 40s, Maria's husband, George, had gone to New York City to help co-found the long-awaited Ballet Society. This is something that he and another gentleman had been working on for a long time. But it was soon renamed the New York City Ballet, which is obviously a very, very famous institution. And Maria had been a guest dancer for other prominent ballet companies throughout the world up until this point. But she joined George at the NYC Ballet and was named prima ballerina, or lead dancer of the company, and that made her America's first prima ballerina. She ended up holding that title for 18 years, which is a really good long amount of time. She and George's marriage was actually annulled after just a few years of being married, but they continued to partner with each other, and it was said that her particular speed, precise movement, and grace inspired George to work just based on her movement forever afterward, and it continued to inspire him. Maria ended up marrying two more times. Her third marriage produced her beloved daughter, Elise. And in the late 1960s, she decided to finally retire from the stage, but she wanted to remain involved in the development of other artists. So she moved to Chicago, where she founded a ballet studio, and she served as artistic director of the Chicago City Ballet. Now, the really cool thing about Maria Tallchief was just she won so many important awards and accolades. Like I could not even list them all, but I did want to highlight a few of them. So in Oklahoma, on January 29th, they celebrate Maria Tallchief Day, and they started doing that way back in 1953. And she was inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame and received the Kennedy Center honor in 1996. In 1999, she received the National Medal of Arts, which is the highest honor given to artists by the U.S. government. She ended up passing away in Chicago at age 88. So this woman revolutionized what it meant to be a ballerina. She really impacted the world of dance. I really encourage everybody to go onto YouTube and look up videos of her dancing. Seeing her in action is really what gives you a sense of her talent. She doesn't look like other dancers. We all kind of have this idea of what a good ballet dancer looks like. I read in several places that she had this great speed. You've got to go watch her make her turns. I just think she looks so cool. She makes it look so effortless. I love watching her being lifted by a male partner. She looks completely weightless, and that's all based on her control. She's got such great control. I love watching ballet. I just think it's such a remarkable art form. I also really love watching figure skating for the same reason. I love it when people are so good at it that they make it look easy and effortless, and you know they are basically working their ass off. But I wanted to share a quote to kind of sum up her career and her thoughts on her legacy. So Maria Tallchief once said the following: "Above all, I want to be appreciated as a prima ballerina who happened to be a Native American, never as someone who was an American Indian ballerina." I wanted your reaction to that quote, Kaylee.
I think I have mixed feelings about that quote. I get it. And what I'm interpreting from it is she wanted to be known for her talent. I wish the world didn't put pressure on people of color to be these representatives of diversity and these representatives of their culture. Like, if they want to be, that's good and that's fine. And I hope everyone is proud of their culture and their ethnicity or racial background. But it is a shame that I do think society puts people in a box and it's like, oh, isn't she great for a Native? Or isn't she a novelty because she's a Native and she's doing this? So I do hear that. But I wish she didn't have to make that quote, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, sure. I wish she didn't have to make the quote as well. But I wanted to say that I get it. I get what she's saying. And I get it because I have gone through similar things. I'm not a ballerina, but I have gone back and forth with a lot of places. Okay, so I'll just lay it out like this. I, for anyone who doesn't know, I have worked in the past a number of times as a playwright, and usually a commissioned playwright where a company will ask me to write a play for them, usually based on some sort of theme that they have or subject matter. And on a few occasions, they have asked me to write a project about a Native event or person. And sometimes what ends up happening with projects like that is you can wind up feeling a bit tokenized.
Yeah.
I know I've gone back and forth with people where, you know, I'll see like a press release go out, or I'll be asked to approve of a press release going out. And I'll write back and say, hey, can you not list me as Kara Morrison, Native American playwright? Because, mm-hmm. you know, we wouldn't be saying, I'm going to make up a name here,
Biff Charlington.
Sure. If Biff Charlington wrote an original new play for the same company and he was white, would we be saying white playwright Biff Charlington?
Well, they wouldn't need to because his name would say it all.
Well, that aside. But yeah, I don't like to feel like that. And also it feels a bit icky. I get why people do it. You don't want anybody questioning, hey, do you have somebody involved who knows what they're doing or talking about? And I get that. But at the same time, it's just like, I'm a playwright and I am Native. We don't do this to white playwrights. We don't do this to white ballerinas. And it doesn't just happen to Native people. You know, people might say Asian American musician, you know, whatever it is. It's like, why?
Yeah. I definitely think it should be to the discretion of the artist, because sometimes I do like to include that just for like, I like to represent and I like to be like, hey, there's a native in this space. Let's get used to natives being in artistic spaces, you know, but I have definitely had people do it to me without my permission. Like when I've worked for companies and I've seen my name, I've literally seen my name on sheets of paper that next to my name says Native American, and I never gave anyone permission to put my race or my ethnicity on anything. I've been thrown in front of grant committees. I've been thrown in front of grant committees as an example of diversity within the company when I did not, I was like put on the spot and I was like, I didn't give you the right to identify me. And when I do try to bring up diversity in this company, I get shot down. So that's all I'm going to say about that as a former employer. But yeah, so I think that should be the discretion of the individual artist. I'm glad she was there. I wish, because you know, Karen, you and I, we studied dance for a long time. We both did ballet for a long time. I love ballet. I wish I could still participate in it regularly. I did not know about Maria Talchief when I was a child growing up in the 90s. I wish I had. I wonder if I would have felt better, because I always felt super out of place in ballet class. And to my memory, there weren't other Native kids in our dance classes. There were other kids of color, but they probably felt similarly because the majority of the other students were white. I definitely feel like a white world, you know, unless you were in, you know, less traditionally white dance styles. But yeah, I wish I could have had that representation in the forefront. Like I wish she was almost more famous, I guess. She's very famous, but I didn't know about her when I was young.
Yes, same. I first found out about her in college, actually. I remember I just happened to be at a public library and I found her. She has an autobiography. I believe the title is America's Prima Ballerina. And she co-wrote it with someone else. But I found the book on the shelf. And just because I have an interest in ballet, I flipped through it. And flipping through it, somewhere I read in there that she was Osage. I was just like, oh, wow. Not only did I not know of this person, she was also Native. That's really cool. So I do, obviously, as a Native person, I grasp onto knowing that she's Native. But going back to the quote, I get where she's coming from, where she wants her talent, her ability, her career, her achievements to stand alone. And then the fact that she's Native is a part of her, but it's not necessarily directly tied to her career. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Yes, yes. Yes, we know the name Misty Copeland today. Does the general public, do we have a lot of household names that are ballerinas? No. Maria Talchief is up there. A lot of people do know her name. I was watching some game show the other day and she was the answer to a question. But I want to see a movie made about her. I want to know more.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. I really want to read her book. I should say that day at the library, I did not have a valid library card, so I did not get to take the book home. And that was years ago. I still remember it. Maybe I'll purchase the book. But yes. Okay. So I didn't know this either. Her sister became a very accomplished ballerina as well, but there were several other native of Oklahoma ballerinas that were very prominent in the United States. I don't have their names, unfortunately, but there's statues dedicated to the five. There's five of them in total. Like, wow, Oklahoma was really pumping out the native ballerinas.
Interesting.
Yeah, but definitely a really cool lady. And I should say she was involved in a lot of American Indian causes, and she definitely contributed a lot.
Yeah, she did. I think, especially back then, once again, it was so assimilation and denial of being Native was just rewarded, basically, and you were punished if you didn't do this thing. So I'm glad she held on to her culture and she was a champion of those issues. But yeah, I'm not an expert on Maria Talchief, but like I've seen videos of her. So yeah, please go on YouTube or find images and videos of her dancing, because it's something to see.
It really is. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I think that's going to be it for us today. Thank you again for joining us. And quick reminder, if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, which I know most of you are because I can see where you're listening. I can't see who you are, but I know you're listening on Apple Podcasts. And if you are, please take a second to rate and give us a nice review. That's really helpful. Also, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Twindigenous Podcast and like us on Facebook at Twindigenous. You can also support us, help keep this sustainable. We put a lot of work into this. You can support us on patreon.com/twindigenous. And yeah, continue to tell people about us because we love doing this and we want to have fun and laugh with you all, but also get the word out on some Native stories too.
Yep. And Kaylee and I are going to have a lot more conversational episodes coming up. So if you have any topics, please submit that to us on our Instagram and our email account.
Yes. And the email is twindigenouspod@gmail.com. And we're also going to be having a Vogue battle. So look out for that as well.
Sure.
All right. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.